everybody. Welcome to the No Film School podcast for the week of March 20th, 2024. I am Charles Hain. I'm here with Gigi Hawkins.
Hello there.
Jason Hellerman.
Good morning.
This week, we are starting with the Ask No Film School that we were going to get to last week in the intro, and then we never made it to. But we're starting with it this week because it's a good one, and it's one we haven't talked about in a while, and I think it's interesting to unpack. Then we're going to talk about the movie that we think led us to want to make movies, and whether or not we think that would lead other people to wanting to make movies. We're going to wrap it all up with a new regular segment I can't participate in called Lessons from Survivor. But I love that it is out there. And I will do lessons from whatever movie I happen to have watched last night, which is Julio Torres's Problemista, from which we can learn plenty of lessons. Little date night with the wife. Got a sitter. Nothing makes you feel older than hiring a babysitter. Like, I have a mortgage and a wife and a child, and I did not feel nearly as old as, like, walking out the door, talking to a sitter, being like, we'll be back. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm so old. All right. That's neither here nor there. That's not podcast filmmaking relevant.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
First up, this week, we had a great question from a listener named Gavin that I wanted to dig into and give a surprising, maybe frustrating answer to. So, Gavin has a dream of being in the film industry, and we've opened their eyes to how difficult it can be. I'm not sure if I feel good about... I don't want to scare anybody. You can make a living in this industry. There's plenty of stuff to do.
Yeah.
Maybe you can't in 2023 or 2024, but I have a confidence about 25. I feel like next year is going to be a good year. So Gavin is going to make a single video, a demo for some investors in a tech product. So they need to shoot a single scene with an actor and a laptop, and they need to like demo what's happening on the laptop. That's part of the world that Gavin works in. And Gavin asks, like, what should I get? What camera and what boom and whatnot should I get? For $1,000. And I'm going to answer Gavin's question, but we're going to do this thing called burying the lead, where I'm going to save the answer for Gavin's question and actually say, Gavin, I don't think for $1,000 you would be best served by buying things. I think for $1,000 you would be best served by hiring someone. Mm-hmm. And I see by the nods of Gigi and Jason that they already knew I was going to go there. Probably some of the listeners already knew I was going to go there. But here's my basic argument. For $1,000, you're not going to end up with a camera any better than the camera on your phone. And for $1,000, you're not really going to end up with stuff that's going to end up growing with you as you start. If you decide to start booking freelance jobs, they're going to grow with you. If there's one thing you should maybe get, it's sound equipment. Maybe you can justify buying that in that budget, like put $200 on sound and $800 in hiring someone. But that would be about it, because what I really recommend people do is that I recommend people buy equipment when they have jobs regularly justifying it, where you're like booking three or four things a year where you have to do a shoot where it's going to pay for itself, mm-hmm. and where it can grow with you to maybe start booking slightly bigger things. Short of that, it takes time to get to know your gear and to learn how to use it. And you want to, you know, for $800, depending upon what market you're in, but frankly, even in New York or LA, if you said, I want to hire someone for $800 for a day, I would like you to come out and help me shoot this thing and camera and sound. I know a lot of younger people that $800 a day is still a reasonable amount for them to go out for a day to shoot something, and they'll have a camera and they'll have sound and they'll do it and they'll show you what they're doing. You'll work together. You'll figure out shots. You'll have their physical labor in addition to all of their equipment. You'll see what they're doing. And I think you will be much better off if that is your budget, not buying gear. I realize this is not what you asked for. You asked for what gear do I spend my $1,000 on? But I'm telling you, $1,000 is like what? A $500 camera, $100 tripod, and $400 in sound. I'm going to give some recommendations in there. Oh, and you want $200 or $300 light. I'm going to give some recommendations in that budget, but I don't think you'll be happy with what I can recommend. And I think you'll outgrow it really quickly. Mm-hmm. And it's better to use this as an opportunity to practice what most professional filmmakers do, which is write. The vast majority, I say this in an office surrounded with gear, but I'm also a teacher and I do a lot of weird stuff. And sometimes I have gear just to play with it. I've got like a, you know, there's a great YouTube video out there about the old X-ray lens that Zeiss made in the 60s, the 0.7. I got one of those. Like, I'm not normal. Most working filmmakers, one of the biggest DPs, David Mullen, is like, I own 3 light meters. I bring them in one case. That's all I own. Everything else is a rental. Most professionals rent because gear has wear and tear and you outgrow it. And especially in an age where, like, if you have an iPhone from the last 5 years or an Android from the last couple of years in your pocket, that camera is so good that if you're thinking, oh, well, I want to have a camera so I can practice, I can shoot little scenes with friends and I can always practice, you probably already have that camera.
Yeah.
You want to spend money on the gear that you can make money with. And like half the gear in my office, I've made money with in some way, shape, or form on freelance jobs or whatever. Half of it's just weirdo stuff. And some of it I rent because I'm like the one person on the East Coast who has some weird thing and there's actually a market in renting it. But the vast, you will be way better served by renting this gear than you will be by buying it. So why am I not saying going on ShareGrid? You should go on ShareGrid. ShareGrid is a local peer-to-peer rental platform. So even if you're not in a major market, if you are in a major market, the rental houses all have their stuff on ShareGrid. But even if you're not, if you're in a small market, go on ShareGrid. You can find stuff to rent at that rate. The other thing is, like, it takes time to learn how to use your gear.
Yeah.
And $800 will get you a person for a day who will come out and work with you to figure out to plan shots, and they'll know their gear and they'll hand over footage and it'll be prepped right. And you'll walk away having learned so much by that experience without having gear to then worry about where you store and how you maintain and if it breaks and insurance. You will be way better off. If you really want to do $1,000 worth of gear, you should break it down like 400 camera, 100 tripod, 300 sound, 200 a light. So you have at least a light. That's $1,000. That's not going to go very far. You can get like a nice little Aputure MC30 or two for $100 each. I like those lights, or the MC Pro. They're nice. I don't know what I would say for a $100 tripod. I think Benro is probably the $100 tripod. And I honestly don't know what I would say for, I do know what I would say for $300 in sound. Instead of a boom, everybody, you've seen them on TikTok. If you're on TikTok, I am not. But like, they're either called the Rode Go, or DJI has the DJI Go, or Movo makes a Movo Go. And it's a nice little thing. And it's like two little wireless lavs you can clip on people's necks and a receiver. And then for $400, buy the nicest used Sony you can get for $400, which will be a couple years old, but something. Did I steer wrong in any way?
I think that's a satisfying answer. I feel like you have answered Gavin in multiple ways. Like, you can move forward this way if you really want to have your own stuff, but practically, this is the alternative. This is what would be seen as normal. And I think you bring up a really important point about buying gear. It's an investment that requires management if you want it to be something that you're renting out. Like the DP on my movie, he shares a camera with a guy, and they rent it out through Rare Breeds here in LA, and sometimes they can't use their own camera because it's already rented. So it takes time and energy to manage that as well. And what you don't want is like an investment like that to be sitting there and not being used.
Yeah, I've worked in commercials, you know, a fair amount, and one of the directors I work for a lot used his first like $1 million to buy a bunch of equipment, and he said, and now he rents it from himself, you know, when he does commercials. And he was like, it's like, you know, that's a backdoor way, but sans being a millionaire, you know, I think there's a lot of other ways. And, you know, it's funny, you know, that was, let's say, like 35 years ago. He's older now, but just going off your point, Charles, every famous DP in Hollywood rents his stuff and like through him. They're not like, oh, I'm using my personal Alexa, or I'm using, you know, my personal Stanley Kubrick Zeiss lenses. You know what I mean? It's like, no, I'll go pay a fee, you know, rent for however many days through whatever, and then go home. You know, and I think at the end of the day, having gear is always fun, right? Like, that's what I love about like Grips, and, you know, you just like go over to their house and they're like, here's, you know, here's my bag, here's my whatever. But at the end of the day, when you're making something, it's mostly about access, and spending to rent or spending on a person always turns out better than many a times I've been like, what can I do with this Canon 5D in my apartment? And like, I have no idea what I'm doing, and I waste a weekend just getting shots that would be, you know, practicing for the big day instead of actually, you know, fulfilling what my budget entails.
It's such a good question though, Gavin, because like, how would you even know? Like, where would you even know if you weren't in the industry or knew somebody in the industry? So I'm so glad you asked it.
Yeah, no, it's a wonderful question. I'm really grateful for it. I like getting to riff on it. And I understand the instinct. I had the same instinct where I was like, once I get a camera, then I'm on my way. But then once you have a camera, you watch how much it sits, how much it doesn't work for you. And the big thing too is that, like, obviously there's that famous story of Werner Herzog breaking into the film school in Munich and stealing their Arri 35-3 and then used on like his first four features, right? Like, we've all heard that story. He tells it quite well. He tells it in interviews where he was like, I wasn't stealing anything. That camera was meant to be mine. I saw it and I realized it was mine.
That's what I told the person at H&M when I stole a tank top in seventh grade. It was meant to be mine.
It was yours.
It was mine. My mom didn't agree. Made me bring it back.
Security guard at the mall probably didn't agree either.
It was a low point.
Yeah, I mean, every 11-year-old does that once. And then you're like, oh, wait a minute. No, we pay for products.
Yeah. Except for Werner Herzog.
Yes. I suspect at this point, Werner Herzog has probably made that right with the Munich Film School. Yeah. But that's not as good a story, so it doesn't end up in the interview. But like, I understand that instinct. But also, in the digital era, shit ages fast.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my. Like, it is not the same as like, for instance, I have some weird lenses. Why am I willing to spend money on weird lenses? Because a lot of these are already 40 years old, so their price depreciation's already baked in. And I bet I'm going to get another 40 years out of them in some weird way, unless AI erases everything. But like, every digital thing you buy loses 40% of its value the second you buy it, because it's digital. And in a couple of years, it will be considered out of date. Like, it's crazy how fast digital depreciation is. And right now, like, you know, I have projects this year that are making me buy things for the projects this year. And even the projects I have that are justifying the price, I'm a little bummed because I'm like, oh, I bet there's going to be a new one of these next year. And like, it's, you know, so it's like, it's very hard in this period of rapid technological advance to justify, unless you are booking the regular jobs to do it. If you're booking the regular jobs to do it, like your commercial director friend, obviously buying the gear is cheaper than renting it like four times a year. So once you're at the point where you're renting a thing four or five times a year, then you should buy it, of course. But you got to get to the point where you're renting it four or five times a year to justify the investment, usually.
Yeah. And it's hard to get to. It does take time. I think the rush in always is, oh, I have to have it now because it'll make me feel legit. You know, if I have it, I'm a filmmaker. It's like, no, just making stuff makes you a filmmaker, you know, shooting things.
Making stuff. Yeah, make stuff. Make more stuff. All right. Hopefully this was not a frustrating answer, Gavin, and that it's going to pivot us over to our next conversation, which is the movies that made us want to make movies, which honestly, I'm 25 years into this and no one's ever asked me that question before. Mm-hmm. So this is the first time I've ever had to answer it. But Jason, we're going to make you go first.
Yeah, totally fair. This is a topic I came up with mostly by random, you know, it's just kind of how I come up with all my topics, right? But yesterday, we're recording this, yesterday was St. Patrick's Day. And I St. Patrick's Day, big holiday in my family when we're growing up. You know, my maternal grandmother, you know, was kind of like fresh off the boat. And, you know, it was a big holiday. And I remember being in, let's say, fourth grade, and her and my grandpa taking me into Philadelphia to a movie theater called The Ritz at the Bourse. And it was like our independent, you know, film theater, like they had foreign titles that ran there. And we went and saw Waking Ned Divine. And I just remember, that's a great movie. If you haven't seen it, it's sort of about these two guys who try to con the lottery in Ireland. And it's just wonderful film. And I remember that being like, this is a film, right? This isn't I'm not watching Disney with my parents. I'm not watching Indiana Jones, which, you know, much later I would find out, you know, what it was a big, you know, took some craft, right? But this was a film. This is a movie. And I couldn't predict it, right? It was toying with my emotions. There was laughter. There was sadness. There was, you know, a touch of sex, you know, which in fourth grade, maybe all you need, right?
But just a touch.
Yeah. Like deeply thinking about that and watching it. I watch it every St. Patrick's Day, you know, to this day. And I was like, you know what? I feel like this was the first movie I watched that felt like a movie that made me think like, oh, there are people doing this. Someone came up with these ideas that, you know, there's like someone behind the camera, someone behind doing things. And that for me is like, oh yeah, like that was the spark, right? I can do this. I remember like going home and telling my parents. My parents were like, what happens in this movie? There's two naked old men who ride a motorcycle. It's like one of the best parts of it. And Roger Ebert mentions in his review as the best case of on-screen male nudity to date, you know, or the funniest case. It's, you know, something I always strive to beat. But, you know, there's like that to me felt so formative and so like, you can do this. You can subvert expectations. You can have a little of these things, you know, a touch of this and a touch of that, kind of genre bendy. And I think to this day, like every time I sit down to write something, it's a movie that's at the forefront of my mind. And also just a movie I love telling people to watch because I think it's so unpredictably fun and loving and warm that it definitely was like, oh, okay, like maybe I could do this, you know, like maybe this is something. And that for me would be like my, you know, my pick overall.
Man, you have like a much more nuanced answer than I'm going to give.
Well, that's why I guess well, I mean, with me, you know?
Yeah, well, it's what's so funny is that having to think through this question, you're sort of having to think back of like I remember being really young and we were watching a movie and there was a werewolf in it. And I was asking my parents to define the difference between a movie and a cartoon.
Oh, I love
it. And like, I remember that moment of like, what is the difference? Like, why is one like photographed and one's drawn? Like trying to unpack that. I remember that. But I think the movie that actually had the most impact on me wanting to do this. And it's interesting because I don't have that self-reflexive memory you have of like recognizing it as a movie, but I do remember becoming particularly obsessed with the movie Clue.
Oh yeah.
It was the movie that I watched so often. Yeah. And there's so many joys of Clue, but Clue is a movie that has so much joy in dancing with genre.
Yeah.
Recognizing the genre as a thing and playing with it and having fun with it. And, you know, if you haven't seen Clue, famously has multiple endings.
Yep.
And playing with planting and payoff and what are we putting to make each of those endings feel justified. And I remember having so much joy with the dance of those endings as a child that I think that that has a lot to do with what interested me in story and character and genre, which is, you know, the kind of things that make you want to work in movies where you're fascinated in sort of unpacking it and pulling it all apart and seeing how all of the pieces go together. That would be the thing that I look back on and I'm like, oh yeah, that was the messy little knot that I got really wound up in.
Yeah. I get jealous of kids today because they could just go on YouTube, right? Like, and be like making of Clue, you know what I mean? Find these sorts of things that, you know, I don't know. I'll be 37 soon. Like I remember distinctly being like FYE in the mall and like going to like their book section, which is like, you know, it's like movie or for your entertainment is what FYE stood for, which I didn't learn till that store closed decades after they disbanded. But going and like looking for books on movies that maybe they carry or like in a Barnes & Noble in like the $5 bin being like, how do they do these things? And now I feel like everything's a YouTube click away. But I like distinctly remember like ordering books. I was wondering, Charles, did you have like Clue swag that you were doing or just watching over and over?
Yeah. I mean, what's the word that was popular? Transmedia. The concept of transmedia, where you're like, oh, there's also going to be behind the scenes. I knew I wanted to be a filmmaker before I ever saw a behind the scenes how-to video. DVDs. I didn't get a DVD player until I was in film school. So I had already moved to Los Angeles before the concept of watching ancillary media in support of like how something was. I already knew I wanted to be a filmmaker before I read my first IMDb trivia page.
Yeah.
I remember it was The Godfather. And I was like, holy shit, there's all this stuff about I had no idea that like The Godfather was special and that not every film would have 480 trivia entries. But I remember just reading it and reading it and reading it and being like, there's so much here. So I'm probably in that last wave of people that very much just had the end product of cinema
Yeah.
Just had the like, oh, this is the thing. And I was curious about that, but I had no avenues whatsoever into any behind the scenes video, any content, any interviews, anything. Like none of that existed. Amazing. In my youth.
My entry point in that, in sort of that behind the scenes content, it was always what was living within the VHS. So sometimes before there'd be a little teaser, sometimes after. And the sort of entry point for me, I think, starts with Shirley Temple. I believe my grandparents had a whole box set of all the Shirley Temple movies, and they'd give me one for every holiday. So I was sort of being piecemeal fed these stories, and they would always have sort of a teaser before and after. But I never was one to be like, you know, thinking about the process of making the movies necessarily beyond seeing the behind the scenes stuff. But I think I connected so much as a kid with the idea of being inserted into these stories. And I was very, very drawn to these stories with kids where the stakes were high and the stakes were real. And there was this unpacking of emotions and this true darkness in a lot of these older films. And the other thing I watched a lot were the old Little Rascals, where, you know, these kids against these mean adults. And I was very drawn to that darkness. And I remember very viscerally playing pretend, but playing as if I were in a movie. So somebody was watching me and I'd be going through these movie-like scenarios where, like, well, all my parents are dead and I am alone and I have to survive. And that was, I think, my first schematic for ultimately being a director. I was also a very bossy little kid who would make people play other parts. So, you know, if I was at Nicole Wilberdeen's house as a guest, I'd say, okay, you be the boy, I be the girl, and we're going to play this scenario out. And like that was, and then if she was at my house, I'd be like, okay, it's my house, so you be the boy, I'll be the girl. We play out the scenario. And so I clearly had a lot of taste, but it was a lot of like following the story trajectory of these darker kid stories. Another one that comes to mind is The Secret Garden, where it's like these things where there are hidden secrets and it's all these characters withholding information. And that drama and character layers, like I was with these like dark overhangs, like I was always playing that out. I don't think it was until I was in middle school and I was watching The Royal Tenenbaums by myself, sneaking it, did I start to think that it's possible that I could potentially craft something and seeing the mechanics of, and I've talked about this before, but I remember viscerally feeling the pain of Luke Wilson's character when he is attempting suicide and feeling that pain, but also feeling this curiosity because it was so stylized. And that marriage, which was so bizarre, was so satisfying and interesting to me. And that's when I started to be like, oh, you can take this thing that's like aesthetically appealing in a way that is so unexpected and marry it with this darkness. And that's when I started to like create outside of just playing pretend. And it always comes back to this idea of putting myself in the shoes of the protagonist and being in this dark place and that visceral connection. And I think there's like an escapism that I got as a kid that I continue to come back to. And I think that's why whenever I'm creating something, it's always like starts from a very dark character place with lots of layers of secrets. And I go back, I actually recently rewatched The Secret Garden and I'm like, this is dark and weird. And this, again, the stakes are real. The very first thing that happens is her parents die in a fire and she's stuck under a bed and it's beautiful. And I like actually am kind of nostalgic for that time where we weren't sanitizing kids' stories. We were letting the kids sit with it. And I think that's healthy.
Yeah. So I'll give you both a follow-up question to make it even harder. Let's say you have a hypothetical friend and they're like, oh, I'm not really into movies. Like, what should I watch to get more into cinema, if you will? How do you show them? What do you show them? Because you have a friend, like if you're going to like go back in time and talk to young Gigi, Is there a way, like, is there a movie you would show her sooner or different things like that? Or Young Charles? Young Charles sounds like a TV show.
Sounds like a TV show.
I mean, it's Young Sheldon for sure. But Young Charles on CBS.
I mean, first off, how do you end up with a friend who's not into movies?
I don't. You know what? It's all LA Gen Z parties. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Some parents don't love them, you know. Yeah.
My brother, who is a sophomore in college, he said he didn't really like movies that much. Like we sat him down and forced him to watch Jurassic Park, and he wasn't loving it. And I think, and meanwhile, my dad's like standing in the kitchen watching and scared, but doesn't want to get close because he's too scared. He frights very easily. But for Luke, I took him and I forced him to see Parasite in theaters. So something that I think, so for somebody who's wary of movies or cynical of them, I think I like to, you know, show them something that's tongue-in-cheek and dark and weird. And Luke says it's his favorite movie. I don't know how many other movies he's seen, but, you know, he has watched. But I think something, I try to show them something that's modern and self-aware.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I had never really thought about that, but it is sort of a challenge to think like, oh, you're either very into like specific forms of television or you're very into video games. And what is your gateway drug to recognizing cinema as a thing? The first movie that comes to mind is actually, the reason why it comes to mind is it came out when I was in college and I remember a friend watched it and I remember her talking about it later and it was clear it was the first movie that she was like, wait, there's more to this movie than just like, and it was Being John Malkovich. And she got like obsessed with it. And she went back and saw it again like a month later in theaters because that was back when art movies could play in theaters for like 3 months. I think it is a good movie in that it works very well on a surface level of being very funny and it's got movie stars and they're doing stuff and Malkovich is hilarious. But there's also subtext and nuance and themes and there's stuff to unpack and dig into. And I think that could be a good gateway drug to like a 90s kind of like, we've got our celebrities, but we're trying to do something a little different. We're trying to like be more interesting, but it sort of makes fun of itself and it recognizes the potential to be pretentious and dances with it. I think there's something interesting in that. I mean, the real danger is, yeah, if I had a friend who was like, I'm not interested in the pretentious movies you're into and I only want to watch, like, I don't know what I would make fun of. It is a tricky thing because, you know, I mean, I'm sure everybody saw it, went around, everyone knows I like the Fast and the Furious movies. So everyone sent me screenshots of Chris Nolan talking about how much he likes them. And I was like, of course he likes them. Chris Nolan loves cinema and the Fast and the Furious movies are cinema.
Yeah.
And it's like, Tokyo Drift or Fast Five would also be on my list of like, let us watch. Like if someone said to me they didn't watch movies, I would be like, well, we have to watch Tokyo Drift and you have to tell me that again. Because I cannot imagine a human with two lungs, two ears and two eyes and a heart not loving Tokyo Drift. Like, I don't even like cars. I'm a biker. But right. Tokyo Drift is just like, it's cinema and magnificent cinema. So that is an interesting question. I don't run into, I mean, I teach at a film school.
Right.
And I live in Brooklyn. So I don't run into a lot of the, like, I don't really, and I spent the rest of my life in LA, like, people like movies. But you're right, there are those people out there who are like, I don't really like movies.
They exist.
My buddy Tim.
Yeah.
What about you, Jason?
There's not a short pier nearby to tell them they could take a long walk on. You know, it is something I'll go back to my childhood again. This is just gonna be my therapy for the week. But I remember my mom, sometimes she would go out of town for work for the weekends and I just have a brother. So me and my brother, my dad would make the one dinner he knew how to make, which was, he called Hellerman hash, but it was just baked beans and hot dogs. Like it was like, you know, and then we would go rent movies to watch, you know, and he always said, he's like, these are the movies your mom, we don't have to tell her what we watch because she's just not interested in these kinds of movies, but it's because they're rated R. You know what I mean?
No.
Like, it was fully like mom's away.
Mr. Hellerman.
Exactly. And I like distinctly remember the weekend we watched The Lawnmower Man and Terminator. And I'm just like, how weird The Lawnmower Man is and how being like a child, I was like, I don't get this at all. But I, of course, understood The Terminator. It was terrifying. And whatever. And, you know, I go back and I think like, something contemporary works. I would find something that feels like modern-ish, but it's like, oh, you should see this because it's part of the cultural lexicon, right? Like, like Parasite's a fun pick because you're like, oh, like at the time, and I still think, you know, partially it's part of existing. You should know this, you know, and that's why I go back to like The Godfather, right? Because it's like, okay, like that's a great movie, but it's also long. So it's hard to get someone to sit for that long to watch something like that. So
right.
If I had to pick anything, I do think it's like, what's a short, you know, what's an action movie that's there in 2 hours. And I'll literally go back to like viscerally remembering The Terminator as a kid, I'll Be Back, you know, all of these things that, you know, the practical effects. So it's either that or Jaws, right? I think Jaws is a movie that feels universal, that's classic enough, but like with modern enough storytelling that you feel, you know, kind of bridges both things. And it'd be hard to pick against Spielberg in that category, right? But, you know, if I had to like encounter an alien from another planet or a Gen Z person who didn't like movies, those are the picks. I think it's how do you get your hooks in them early and do different things? And one of the laments I have probably is the more, you know, the younger generations going more towards this sort of minutia of watching movies, right? Like Paramount mm-hmm. released Mean Girls on TikTok and it was just, you know, let's say like 100 TikToks that you could like watch 1 minute of the movie on, you know, 1 minute and 30 seconds. And I like union pay aside and residuals, it kind of like broke me a little bit because like, what's amazing about Mean Girls is how much it builds and how much you feel like you're on a roller coaster. And watching a minute of it, you're like, wait, who's Caddy? Right? Yeah. Like what's going on? What are these things? It is tough. And I go to a lot of movies in Los Angeles and I like frequently don't see a lot of young people there. But I will say like one of the best times I had recently was seeing Anyone But You, the Glenn yes. Powell, Sydney Sweeney. And it was packed with people, young people, like I guess who love Sydney Sweeney and love Glenn. And I was like, oh, it is fun. It's fun to hear them squeal at these rom-com moments or different things. Like it is like the joy of movie going. And I hope they keep going in packs because you couldn't get that at home, right? If you're watching with your girlfriends or your guy friends or your mixed group of friends at home on your couch, like that's not, it would be a fun movie to watch, but it's special in theaters, you know? And like, that's why it made $250 million. Like it's fun to watch with a group. And I hope more people try to access that, you know, find that access point or entry point, especially the younger generations.
Shout out to all the matinee loners that I watched it with, where we also laughed and squealed and had a good time. And like, I came out, I was like, these are my best friends. We just experienced this together. And then there was one grandparent couple with a granddaughter. They're both like, they turned to each other after like, that was fun. I think you bring up a really good point, Jason, though. Like if you're trying to find an entry movie or like a bring somebody in movie,
yeah,
make sure that it's not something that you love because of like a nostalgia thing.
Right.
Because that is not going to win friends and influence people into movies. Like it has to be something that they're going to be surprised and delighted by. And then maybe follow up with like the one where you're like, okay, now you like this movie. You're going to love this one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is this our pivot into Survivor Time?
I think so.
Okay, so this is a segment, and it's a short segment that we're doing during this season 46 of Survivor, and it's what lessons can we get from this non-narrative show about Survivor? And here's my takeaway. In this week, there was a human being who was real and was living in a totally different world than everyone else in the show. And, you know, in this heightened drama, this is just a person who feels emotions and is so psyched to be on Survivor, but like, I just don't think is playing the game strategically. And it's leading to this dynamic.
I'll say maybe my least favorite human of all time to ever be on the show.
It's not fun to watch. And it's also like creating drama that doesn't feel earned at all. So I think that brings me to a lesson about this. Every character, like obviously there's situations where like you have the odd man out, you have the straight man, you have the crazy person, but like if somebody is feeling these extreme feelings and it's not earned and everyone else is kind of like, what's going on? Like it just feels soapy and boring.
I think that's a good one. One of the things I thought is this week, everyone, so the person Gigi talked about, everybody, they're on the chopping block, right? If you can't stand a person, you're going home, right? If you're stuck on an island, that's the person going home. But Survivor, what I think it does well is it has unpredictable twists and turns. And what happened was someone on a different tribe hurt their arm and had to be medically disqualified. So this person just gets to stick around another week. And I'm sure the producers somewhere are fist pumping, right? Because they know hate watching and having a big, loud characters, whatever. But I thought it was like, what a twist that you couldn't foresee coming that was earned, right? This guy like, you know, falls on his arm or whatever. Like you're like, uh-oh, here it is. And
not even dramatic. He sleeps funny
He sleeps wrong on his arm and pinches a nerve where it doesn't work anymore, which is now a new horror that I'll live with every night. But, you know, that sort of unpredictable twist that bails a bad person out. We see that all the time, right? That happens in Game of Thrones frequently. Like it's something we see like that has like a real narrative application and something I don't see people do enough, right? Like certain shows like Game of Thrones does it all the time, right? It's like, oh, this person's going to die, but actually they get bailed out because Cersei's doing this or, you know, we like all these people. They go to the Sept, she blows it up, whatever. Maybe watching a lot of Game of Thrones recently, but you know, you're always finding these landing points. And I think when I'm watching these reality shows, I'm always thinking, well, what's their cut to make us feel the same emotions that film and TV are, right? Like that narrative stuff is. It's like, what are those beats that translate or that are quote unquote universal? And I think what you said is too, right? That big character with big emotions, you know, like what are, like we have a visceral reaction to that person. I mean, I think about like movies and TV and like villains, like who do you hate? Who's weird? If you've seen Dune 2, the Austin Butler character, you're just like, this guy's a freak. You know, like he's terrifying. You feel these kind of things because they give them big things to do. And then it's also like, how do you use those big things to your advantage? This character does not use it to his advantage. But I think if you're a producer of that TV show, you're loving it because you're like, oh, this is, I could put him in every promo, you know, so.
I don't watch Survivor, but I will say I work in an office and everyone was discussing this week's episode here this morning. So for whatever it's worth, this week seemed to be a big week for people.
I know, we're only 2 weeks in. Who knows where Survivor can go? Charles, you said you watched a movie last night. You got to go on a date with
I got to see the new Julio Torres movie, Problemista, amazing Tilda Swinton performance. He's fantastic in it. It's the biggest lesson is just like the beauty and power of observation about the world. Like there's many wonderful things about the movie. But one of the things the movie does exceptionally well is it observes very closely and with detail a world that we know and have not seen in such detail. So, you know, it is about an immigrant from El Salvador trying to survive in New York and taking a job working for a art critic who was most successful in another New York and is still living in this New York, driving the Benz they bought when they were successful 25 years ago. And the detail work, I will frequently get annoyed at messy detail work in a movie. Like I will walk out of a movie and we'll all be talking about how we loved it. And I'll be like, yeah, but they had the wrong car. Or like, I didn't buy that watch. Or like, I don't know. Like I love production design. And like one of the many things that Problemista got right is the detail work is phenomenal. So like, you know, there's a scene where they're trying to find something and they unpack her purse and everything in her purse is perfection. And wow. You are like, it is just, you know, these are the things that make that paint a portrait of a place and time in a way that gives you a sense of authenticity and connection and feels real. And like, obviously, the movie is a fantasy. There's big elaborate VFX sequences. Craigslist is embodied in the form of a person who talks. Like, it is a fantasy. But I feel like those fantastical elements work so much better because of the grounding and reality for the moments that are so firmly grounded. I'm not going to say the name of the movie because I don't like to say negative things, but there was an action movie from like 10 years ago I saw with like a lot of fantastic stuff in CGI. But there was like a story moment where some people had to like fix a thing. And they clearly just included the screenwriting temp. Like when you're screenwriting, you can totally write a temp of like two characters fix a scene. They do a thing with this or whatever. But then you should hire a consultant to like help you really dial in exactly what they should do. And they clearly just shot the screenwriting temp. They clearly like, no one on
the
set.
The tools tap and clink in the little.
And I was like,
device.
No one thought to get this right. And it said so much about the whole film to me.
Yeah.
That it's like, no, like the CGI element that they're fighting against would feel way more real to me if you made them fixing the broken machine feel more real.
Yeah.
If you cemented that in actual reality that made sense, I would buy the other more. Because it's about that. And so there's much to recommend Problemista. The performances are great. There's some like true laugh out loud moments. But the big takeaway for filmmakers is just detail work. it's just observation. It's just, you know, a filmmaker should never be bored, because you should walk out on the street and just take notes on what you see, because you can recycle it into something where, man, some of the observations, some of the things, like, are just so pure about the movie and the, like, laser vision it has, that I think everybody should take that away for their work.
It's so satisfying, that exact thing, when you're like, yeah, they would have, like, those 2007 Warby Parker glasses. And,
yes.
And that is, and nothing takes me out of it more when it's wrong. And I'm like, that person would never, or that woman would never wear those heels to this event where she has to walk around, you idiots, you know?
Well, no, like, but it can also sometimes be really satisfying where you're like, they wouldn't have that. And then halfway through the movie, you're like, oh, that's why they have that.
Yes.
Can really, you know, I mean, the famous example of that is Lost, when season 3 or season 4, they were doing one of the Lost flashbacks and he had the wrong phone.
Yes.
And like everybody, you know, we used to watch Lost together in film school, or maybe it was after film school, I don't remember. And I remember everybody, like, I remember someone being like, no, they wouldn't have had that phone. That wouldn't have existed. And then the end of the episode, it turned out it was a flash forward after the island. And
we
all
back.
Fucking exploded.
Yeah.
Incredible. Shout out to our Stephen Williams podcast interview. One of the producers of Lost. Oh, this was, I want to come back to the satisfying details of movies, because there's so much good stuff there. But shall we wrap it up?
Yeah. Folks are on the internet. I'm not really on the internet anymore. I'm kind of done with it. Where are you guys on the internet?
I'm on Instagram at Lost in Graceland. And tomorrow we have our intimacy coordinator roundtable, which is a fascinating hour and a half long conversation that I'd say is one of our, you got to listen to this, everyone.
I can't wait to listen to that.
I know. I was going to say, yeah, I'm pressing download now. I'm at Jason Hellerman across the Twitters and the, or X's, or whatever we're supposed to call it now. And Jason at nofilmschool.com. If you have questions or comments or whatever, happy to read. If you hate a director or a movie we wrote about, I don't care. You could save those emails. Someone wrote me a really long email we got on Saturday, and I thought I was in trouble for half of it. And the other half, I was like, there's nothing I could do. If you don't like a certain director and I wrote about it, write your own article. That's all I've got for you. I know you're a listener. You mentioned
article.
It in the email that you're a listener. You seem very lovely. I don't care.
Write your own article is such a great, like, comeback. Like, I feel like the next time somebody honks at me in traffic, it would be like, write your own article.
Yeah. Do it. Yeah.
Incredible.